Sandra, there we are reflecting on 5 billion years of memories. Yes. This is a logical kind of conclusion once you realize that our first cell is alive. Actually, it originated out of the fusion of sperm and egg. Is a 4-hour long process. So they need to calibrate, they need to tune into each other. And if you consider that the sperm and the egg each have a shelf life or cell life of, say, 3 days, then 4 hours is quite a lot of time out of that. So in understanding that the cell actually originated from living cells, we need to go back one generation, because your first cell then came out of the cells of mommy and daddy, but they got their cells from mommy and daddy, and mommy and daddy on the other side as well, and they got their cells from mommy and daddy, and so on. So in that sense, you can realize that the cell that you have has been living for as long as humanity has been living. And if you believe Darwin, who said that he descended from the apes, then it's just going back from humans to hominids to apes to monkeys to animals to plants to small plants to single cellular organisms the first amino acids at the moment that a lightning crashed on primordial Earth, and in its wake got the atoms of the air to string together to form the amino acids. So that means that first amino acid, presumably created out of a striking of the lightning in the primordial gases of the primordial Earth, has then been able to somehow continue its existence, but doing more than that, because of course if an amino acid is like the lightning rod in the wake of a crashing lightning, then how does that amino acid have the internal cohesion and coherence so that it continues to exist in you so much later? Evidently, from the story of biology, we would need to understand that amino acids then created a cluster of atoms, molecules around them, which would then be the foundation of the earlier life forms, which simply means that the amino acid is an antenna formed out of the wake of an electric charge discharge, the thunderbolt in the hand of Zeus, the first creator god, so to say. Then with that lightning rod in the form of the amino acid, it creates an antenna field around it. And in that antenna field, as has been described by Robert Becker, then other atoms can fit in. So that from that level onward, the amino acid would have worked as a strange attractor, doing a kind of puzzling job, finding atoms and molecules which can fit into the electromagnetic field that exists around this magic wand of the amino acid, and that slowly more and more bits and pieces can connect up to it. But it is not just that it connects up bits and pieces as if it is a kind of glass rod which has been electrified and then can be attracting dust, so that you have a cluster of dust hanging on to a glass rod, but rather that everything that connects to the amino acid fits in with the electromagnetic field, and that the electromagnetic field needs to overlap, and that is something which in tetrionics you can neatly model. that every atom is composed of tetrions. Every tetrion is a cluster of four quanta. As a result of its coherent and persistent nature, it is a rigid structure in space and time. The quantum fluctuations of the universal electromagnetic tetrionic quantum field will reflect off that tetrahedral shape. So that means that for every object that exists in the quantum field, there will be a radiative field associated to that object, and that radiating field expands at the speed of light. So that means that for as long as that object, that tetrahedral tetrion, exists, there will be a radiative field around it as many light years away as the age of that specific object. This holds for every tetrion, so that also holds for every tetrion cluster, which means that if you have a couple of tetrions together forming, for example, an electron or a proton or a neutron, and tetrionics is very clear on how tetrions come together, create all the leptons, bosons, the mesons, and so on. They're all very precise shapes of tetrion clusters in that wonderful tetrionic model. And then for each of those shapes, which hang together with a different kind of binding force, they will have a radiative field around them. Just as an aside, because it is so fundamental, in tetrionics, the tetrahedral shape is the foundation of matter. And then when the tetrahedra have a surface-to-surface plus and minus charge bonding, that's called the strong force. When it is rib-to-rib, plus and minus bonding is called the weak force. When it is tip-to-tip, plus and minus bonding is called the derived force. And then the quantum fluctuation field pressure on the object is called the gravitational field. So all of these fundamental forces of physics are in play right there at the deepest level. So when tetrions connect up to form specific subatomic particles, or the atomic subparticles, the proton, the neutron, and the electron, then all of these will have electromagnetic fields around them. This is also the case for the atoms. So every atom is defined by the number of protons, neutrons, and electrons. In tetrions, that is called the deuterons. And so the Z number of the atom defines the number of these deuterons in the atom. But the shape of the atom then very precisely defines what kind of radiative field there will be around that. It is a bit as if you have a holographic projector or a holographic plate, that every particle which exists, every atom which exists, will have a radiative field around it which has a very precise signature shape, corresponding with how the ambient quantum fluctuation around it reflects off, reverberates off that specific atom, and that projects an antenna field, an electromagnetic form field around it, which, as I mentioned, extends as many light years away as the particle exists in years, of course. So once you have that understanding that all of these atoms have these radiative fields around them, which, like antenna fields around them, extend out a really large distances, and then when atoms come together, they need to connect up, and these electromagnetic antenna fields need to match. They need to be able to blend into each other, and they will by themselves already provide a specific kind of coherence, the same kind of coherence as you can find in listening to an orchestra reproducing a symphony. In that case, we are dealing with the soundscape or sound field, in which the vibrations of the sound are interlinked and together form harmonies. In an orchestra, that would be in the form of a time sequence. So it's like a flow of a river in which you can sit and it passes by you. In some other forms of music, such as the singing bowls or the chants or the om chants, they are much more like a stable vibration, which create an ambient field, which is much more like a bath than like a river, because of the change in the vibrational structure of the sound is less. That means that the shape of coherence is more similar, more stable. And then in that way, we can understand that it's not just that there is a sound field which has a coherence of the atoms, but there is also an electromagnetic field which is associated with these atoms because of these antenna fields overlapping and interacting. Likewise, there is also a light field associated with all of these atoms overlapping, interacting, interlocking. And that then results in the spatial field of atoms being connected in specific clusters, which we then call molecules. So I needed to add this into the story because when we're talking about amino acids, we are actually talking about atoms of very specific kind with a very specific kind of radiant field around each specific atom. All of these radiant fields overlapping, interacting with each other, and thereby specifying the kind of coherence that these atoms will have in that structure of the molecule. And evidently, when we talk about radiative fields, and we will talk about coherent wave fields, immediately we can associate that with the notion of a hologram field. And that in that sense, every atom is a hologram projector, that it radiates a radiative field around it, but that the interactions of these radiant fields per atom will create a hologram image for every molecule, for every amino acid. And that, coming back to the amino acids, all of the amino acids will have that extended, coherent, stable, holographic field around them. So while people tend to look at them as a molecular structure of physical matter, of atoms of some kind of form or other, it would be much wiser to understand them as hologram images of resonant, reverberant, vibrational states, as a result of which tetrions could cluster, aggregate, coagulate, and form subatomic particles, form atoms, form molecules which can form matter. So when we are dealing with amino acids, we are dealing with clusters of atoms, not with the level of molecules, materials, but at the level of molecules. Molecules are the transition zone between atoms and materials. So when we are looking at the amino acids with their electromagnetic radiant field, very structured hologram projector image, so to say, around them, then we need to get an understanding of how in that hologram field other kind of atoms can fit in. At the moment, tetrionics is the only realm in which that kind of precision in understanding becomes possible, but a lot of work still needs to be done in the development of tetrionics so that people can see that when you have an amino acid, what these precise radiant fields are per tetron, per atom, and per molecule, to understand how other atoms and how other molecules can then fit into that. And we need that understanding because we need to realize that chemistry is not about receptors of molecules interacting with each other. That's a childish understanding of what happens in physics. Evidently, receptors are aspects of molecules which are antennae within the larger antenna of the whole molecule itself, which means that it is a hologram subsection within the overall hologram of the molecule itself. And then all of these hologram images already reach out with light years of distance, and in closer proximity, by their electromagnetic field, will interweave with other electromagnetic fields by the principles which in wave mechanics would be called amplification and suppression. If you have two waves which start to coincide with each other, you end up with a wave which has the same kind of wavelength, but double the height, double the depth. But if they move out of phase and they sort of cancel out, then you will end up with the notion of having still water, where the one wave goes up, the other wave goes down, and vice versa. The waves are still there, but they cancel each other out. And so when we are dealing with molecules interacting with each other, having sound fields, electromagnetic fields, light fields around them, then these fields will have amplification suppression dynamics between them. It's called the interference pattern of the wave fields. And then by the interference of patterns of the wave fields, there where the amplitude builds up, or there where the frequency shifts, that is where actually radio systems, television systems, computer systems are able to compute that as changes of information in that wave field. And information needs to be understood literally as in formation. The formation of how the wave fields linked to each other is changed. And that actually tells a lot about how things relate to each other and how things can connect to each other. So we need to use tetrionics to fill in an immense gap, which we now can, however, conceptually already understand, that when amino acids link up, it is by these electromagnetic fields with their overlap, which can interlock and which can reposition with respect to each other, that the amino acids can then grow out. And if you trace over billions of years of life, you can then see that the amino acids became the proteins, became the RNA, became the DNA. And then we see that throughout the life forms and throughout all life forms, there is this building up of localized information of survival on Earth, encapsulated in this hologram image storage of these molecules, which act as storage holograms but also as hologram projections, as a result of which they can associate with other molecules in their environment. And as I tend to simplify these leaps of understanding, there's the work of Gaston Nasson and Lynn Margulis, who helps to bridge the gap from the amino acids created out in the wake of the thunder crash on primordial Earth through the primordial gases to where we are now. Gaston Nasson said that when you look under the dark field microscope, you can actually see that the somatites or the spores can grow out to become fungus, which is, say, a fractal linear system. So from a point it goes to a fractal linear system. These can then grow out into a virus, which is actually a double fractal or a planar system. It's a reflection dynamic system. And they can then grow out into microbes, which are actually a projected or spatial system. So in the description of Gaston Nasson, you have the relation between the spore, the fungus, the virus, and the microbe. But they are geometric relationships of expansion of these molecular shapes from a point to a line to a plane to a volume, with the understanding that they are in a way antennae associate with the dynamic of the point, the dynamic of a line, the dynamic of a plane, and the dynamic of the volume. As Gaston Nassens described, the relationship or the kind of forms that emerge, point, line, plane, or volume, or somatype, fungus, virus, a microbe, depend on the circumstances. That would not be the circumstances of the Petri dish or the climate, but that would be the circumstances of the kind of electromagnetic field. Specifically, how the electromagnetic field of the molecules can or cannot link up in larger patterns of coherence. And that, of course, is considered these molecules like tuning forks. Then the way the tuning fork will interact with the other tuning fork by resonance is also determined by the kind of ambient music or the ambient vibrations that takes place around it. And that, of course, is essential for the whole story, that when molecules in this way create their local field around them, and by these local fields around them interact with each other, that this interaction is always within an ambient electromagnetic information field. So that the development of life on Earth is always in integration with the dynamic and the vibration of Earth and the universe. The Earth itself acts as an antenna. The universe is a vibrational field, the quantum field. And so in the interplay of Earth and the universe, which is the same as the interplay between, say, one tuning fork and another, there is this interplay of one molecule and another, like two tuning forks. So there's four wave patterns which then interact. And depending on how the Earth field relates to the cosmic field, the molecular field relating to the other molecular field will have greater or lesser ease in how they can link up. Actually, astrology describes the kind of relationships at that level. So depending on these vibrational circumstances, these molecules can then build up. And that is where the story of Gaston Nassens then builds up into the story of Lynn Margulis, who then says, okay, if you have those microbes which could form, because in those specific settings the gene or the amino acid or the protein was able to assemble other kind of materials around it, in the shape of the fungus, by extending molecules with respect to each other, which is this fractal form of the fungus, or in the virus, in having a plane in which they can sort of connect in multiple directions around a crossing point in that plane, which is then the viral shape, or by creating an envelope around that, as a result of which you then have the three-dimensional sphere dynamic of the microbe. And as Lynn Margulis said, the microbe is then basically defined by having created a double-lipid membrane, a soap bubble, around its core. And if you look at it in the perspective of Phil Callahan, you would then need to understand that this soap bubble is actually like a ball or a sphere antenna, like a radar antenna, in which the vibrations are integrated so that there is an internal plane with internal lines connecting to internal points, and that you then, by connecting the spore, the fungus, the virus, and the microbes, have a hologram image projector with a stable coherence. It can form from the one into the other and back again. But once it is at a microbe, it can connect with other microbes, as a result of which this amino acid, now having been extended with its soap bubble around it, can connect up with other soap bubbles, as a result of which they are more capable to build up coherence within their environment. And that's where Lynn Margulis in her story said, well, when you realize that there are four types of microbes, anaerobic, hydrobic, aerobic, and photosynthetic. The anaerobic is, say, what the alchemist would call the earth. They're without oxygen in the earth. The hydrobic are what the alchemists would call water. They're actually living in the water. The aerobic are the ones that are living in the air. Again, the alchemic element, air. And then the photosynthesizing are the ones that the alchemists would call fire or light. Lynn Margulis then postulated that when these four type of microbes come together, you have the alchemy of earth, water, air, and fire coming together. The Chinese mythology calls that the dragon, the animal that can work with earth and water, air, and with fire. And that then is the basis of what we call the eukaryote cell. So when you look back in history, then there is a plain somewhere in China where they have found the fossil remnants of, I think it was millions of years, in which single cellular organisms started to cluster into multicellular organism. So that essentially is that transition phase which Lynn Margulis described, that single organism could connect up with others, and out of doing that were able to, over a very long period of time, get earth, water, air, and fire elements together, so that the solid, liquid, the gas, and the plasma environments could all be dealt with, and that then a cell originated, the eukaryote cell, which was able to work in the earth, in the water, in the air, and in the light. But that, of course, meant that the core, the gene, had Dawkins with his story of the selfish genes, of course, leaves out the core of the story, that the gene itself is the tuning fork of the magic wand of information, but that the wand is the aggregation, the accumulation of information, and that it is always in interaction with the environment that it can grow or not. So it is not a selfish gene as he describes it, but it must by definition be an altruistic gene, because if it disregards the environment, it will not be able to live in different environments, and so it will very much limit what kind of environment it can live in and not have very great survival chances. While the more variety it can create and the more environments it can live in, the more there will be a possibility to anchor consciousness in a material form on Earth. So coming back with the lightning discharge on the primordial plant through the primordial gases with the formation of the amino acid, then that amino acid diversified in many different ways, in which the formation of the spores, the fungus, the virus, and the microbes was just a step, in which the formation of different kind of molecules or microbes was just another step. And then, as Lynn Margulis says, just another step was the formation of plant forms and the formation of animal forms. Going back to that understanding of the four elements in the four dimensions, the point, the line, the plane, and the volume, then you could say that the eukaryote cell is the point representation of the development of life on Earth. The plant is then the equivalent of the fungus, the fractal formation of cell aggregation on Earth. The animal would be the counterpart of the virus in having an internal kind of plane, which in the animal is called the blood circulation. So suddenly there is an internalized plane of reference mirroring that what goes outside of us. And then from the cell, the plant, the animal, you then get the self-aware animals, which are all those animals in which there is an internal representation of what happens in the environment. Humans, of course, have said that they were the best at doing that. Well, with language and with technology, they were able to communicate best, as a result of which they could inform each other better, and were able to make shelter in more diversified places of Earth. But in fact, any animal that can build a nest has a perspective of creation and thus consciousness in the environment. And any animal that can travel will have an internal mapping of the environment and thus can take decisions about where they want to be on the Earth. And in that sense, consciousness is shared by many life forms, also so-called very primitive life forms. As soon as they can navigate, as soon as they can socialize, as soon as they can orchestrate activities and build coherent constructs, you can see that they operate consciousness and can create their niche in the environment on Earth. So when we have that kind of understanding that humans are part of all of those animals, all of those animals are basically plants with an internalized climate control, and that plants are like spores with the possibility to connect the landscape, the territory with the climate, then we can see that we are actually dealing with a kind of process of learning how to connect consciousness with matter. And then when we look at this development, and then going back to the history of this first lightning crash of Earth, and you now listening to the story, then there's a process of billions of years, and all of that is connected. In your body, you got your cell from your parents, who got it from their parents, and then all the way back through the animals, all the way back through the plants, all the way back through the fungus, the virus, the microbes, all the way back to the amino acids. That has been built into your body, into our body. Because, of course, if we share ancestors, we are all part of the same organism. And that's why I always say every human is a cell in the body of humanity. So in that cell, it's not your body, it's our body. And together we form the body of humanity. But all of us, we have part of that hologram projector. It is that amino acid, which now is the DNA. It's not just the DNA, it's also the circular DNA. So there's also there's a very stable resonator together with an antenna-like variational vibrational resonator. And between the two of them, there is this possibility to tune resonance frequencies. It's like you have a stable note and you have a note which you can change, and out of the two you can have a whole variety of different notes that you can play with. So that's all built into us. Now I'd like to look at the other side of that story, because of course if our body is a couple of billion years old and our DNA, the linear DNA, the circular DNA, are both essentially build up over those billions of years, then we have incorporated immense amounts of information of survival on Earth. And it's helpful here to look at the story of Bruce Lipton, who essentially says that every cell has four antennae. There's a sensory protein, there's a portal protein, there's a linking protein, and a DNA mantle protein. And all of them respond to vibrations, and all of them make it possible for the cell to incorporate information into the DNA. If you look at that in a more general sense, the sensory protein is actually the precursor of the sensory system, with all the sensory cells and all that. The portal protein is the precursor of our whole metabolic tract, the gut system, and the input and output of information and nutrients. The linking protein is actually the connector between the two, which is our intelligence, but also the immune system, the capacity to link information and matter in our body. And the DNA mantle protein say, the capacity to incorporate information into our physical structure. It is our memory, but also the capacity to retrieve memory, and thereby the capacity to tune the hologram projector to create bodies suited to the circumstances. And in that way, every animal species has built its specific kind of DNA to work as a kind of projector, so that the cells know how to position themselves with respect to each other, and then based on that relationship have the capability to produce the molecules by which they can hang on to each other, but also by which they can communicate with each other. So that from the first cell in our body, the cells know how to project that hologram and to unfold that hologram by its projection. And of course, the more cells are projected, the more the hologram is strengthened, and the more the clarity comes of how these cells can link to each other actively by the body materials that they produce, and in a dynamic form by the communication molecules that they produce. It's called the metabolomes. So in that sense, our body and every body is a hologram projector, which is based on the accumulated experience of life in that organism. Bruce Lipton says, in all our experiences, the sensor protein, the portal protein, the linking protein, DNA mantle protein, work together to add new trivial crucial bits of information into the DNA. So over billions of years, that first amino acid has succeeded in adding information into that hologram, and do be aware that this hologram is actually a storehouse of information. Barbara Marciniak, in her book The Earth, a Living, Learning Living Library, addresses that all life forms are part of a library of the development of life on Earth. And of course, via the food chain, all animal forms and all plant forms, all life forms exchange DNA. So they can actually borrow a book from somebody else's live stream and learn from that, read into that, read from that, learn from that, so that all of these life forms interact with each other. One of the well-known examples is Hormesis, where animals can eat plants so that they can make use of specific molecules by which those plants have been able to make sure that there are no parasitical life forms that can thrive off them. So actually the animals then borrow that for their survival, in the same way as there are these colorful fish who eat the toxins found in other food so that they become inedible for other life forms. There's a lot of learning from each other's libraries, and all of DNA on the planet is in this way interlinked. Our DNA likewise goes back into the soil, feeds the worms who feed the plant, who feed the animals, who, and so on. It does mean that when we look at the DNA in that way, we cannot look at it as a structure which we can cut and paste and think that we know what we are doing. The whole GMO story is a very simplified level of understanding. It's a bit at the level where I was when I took apart a little alarm clock, and then at some point had all these bits and pieces on the table, but I was not able to put it together. In the same way, GMO can take things apart and can only pretend to put it together, but as the research, Lynn Margulis and others showed, when they put it together, it is not stable. It will change positions, it will do other things. It is not as predictable as it is, for the simple reason that it is not a mechanical clockwork that you can take apart and put together again, but it's an information system which is holographic, in which there are four resonant fields interacting, overlapping. In our body, that would be the field of the cell, the organ, the body, and the environment. But also, you would have the level of the tetrion, the atom, the molecule, and the matter. So all of these vibrational fields overlap in very complex manners. And it is that vibrational field that is actually what is kept in place by the DNA, the genetic material. And that information field is the accumulated experience of that life form and its ancestors over these billions of years. So take that into account and then realize that when we live, we have that as available memory. We have the genetic memory of the survival of the species and all life forms of Earth. And in a way, you could say that that includes the survival of Earth over all these billions of years. We also have within our body the cells that have the memories of us and our ancestry. That, of course, goes as far back as those were cells, so that doesn't really go into the microbes, the virus, the fungus, and so on before, even though all of that is contained in it, but it is not retrievable in that sense. You need to access it in a different way to be able to retrieve that deeper level of survival information of those pre-existing life form types. So we have the DNA, we have the cell memory, but we also have the organ memory. And the organ memory is, of course, not connected to the ancestry from which we originate and the cells that we share from all of them with the DNA information that they brought together for us. But the organ information is formed after the first cell started to divide and multiply. This zero-sum balance equation by which units maintain unity. And out of that, then the organs are formed, which are diverse because all of the organs together form nodes on a Möbius loop in which the circulation of the food and information chain outside of us can be continued in the other side of the Möbius loop as the food chain and information circulation within us, which then, of course, turns inside out when the information food chain within us via our excrement and urine and seed becomes part of the information around us. So the organs are part of that Möbius loop of internalized, maintained cohesion and coherence of information in our lifetime. And as our brain in a way mirrors, replicates the function of the organs in our body, we also in our brain have our memory of not just our body life experiences, but also of our psychology or mind or mental life experiences. The intent of what we are doing, and not just the actions which we did, but the meaning of the interactions within the context, the physical context, the social context, the universal context, the context of Earth. Actually, a lot of people are schooled to forget the last two, which is to the detriment of Earth and humanity. So you do have that information within you, and that is contained within us. So essentially, this is what we then need as the platform to what it is all about. It is all about the ability to use freedom of choice. So freedom of choice, that's a story in itself. It takes place in the light field, operated in the pineal gland, on which we can then calibrate our involvement, which leads to our identification or disidentification at the level of the decision in the subatomic realm going into the atomic realm, which is then where the electromagnetic comes in, the level of the decision taking. Then once that decision is taken and you identify, crystallize, polarize your interface with the environment, that creates the internal bubble of the experience that you will then pursue in what we then call the conviction or the belief. It's called also the internal climate. It is based on the relationship between the organ glands and thus the interplay of the organs with their Möbius loop inside of us. And that internal climate then reflects on how the cells in our body can be active or inactive. So that determines the cell activity with the reflex levels. So that then is the vertical, the first axis of freedom of choice. And in operating freedom of choice, we then always need to decide or choose how we relate into our environment. But that means we need to calibrate where we are in the now here to what we are in a more broader or general sense. And that is why we needed this extensive story leading up to this part of the tale where we are now, that where we are now and here is that we have a body with a body memory, that we have our organs with the organic memory, that we have our cells with the ancestral cell memories, and that we have our DNA with actually the learning living library of life on Earth contained within it. But that means that if you want to really take good decisions, then you have the help of all of those four memories. So you have the memory of the development of life on Earth, as it is contained in our DNA. We have the development of our species, as it's contained of our cells, which we inherited from our ancestors, which we inherited, those inherited from their ancestors, and so on. So that is simply said as the cells are the memory of humanity. And then, as I said, we also have the memory of the body, which is contained at the organ level. And, of course, we have the memories of what we do, which is associated in the brain. So there is also a cognitive memory or a memory of ideas, which is associated with the space in the core of the brain. All of these four levels operate in totally different dimensions. It's again that relationship between the point, the line, the plane, and the volume. And so when you really want to make decisions, you actually need to go to each of these levels separately, one after the other, to see how your decision, which you want to test out, would compute in relationship to what your memory knows, what your body memories knows, what your organ memories knows, and what your cell core memory knows. But that means that you need to be able to shift in the four levels of consciousness, because the memory in the brain is associated with our environment, which is associated with the beta brainwave frequencies. The memory of the body is associated with what happens when you close your eyes and you go to the alpha brainwave levels and essentially go into the body memory levels. The memory of the organs is at the theta brainwave levels, which is also the level of healing and resetting the internal conditions. And of course, the deepest level, that of the delta brainwaves, is that of the cell memories, which contains the ancestral DNA and all the memories going way beyond. So that means if you want to take a decision, it's not just enough to sort of think about it. My exploration on thinking thoughts or thoughts about thoughts shows that thinking is just this very superficial aspect of our cognitive process dynamic. So when you just think about it, you're only working with what you know and not with what else could be. So you need to think deeper. So once you have a situation and you think about it, then you need to actually go into a kind of daydream trance and say, okay, this is what I think, but now what can I feel? How would that work? What do I know from the body? In my body, what experiences do I have in this lifetime? Not just this moment, but in my lifetime, what experience do I have of where it went right and where it went wrong? Let's just acknowledge that how it went right seems to be the logical thing. But now let's include what went wrong and let's learn from that and see how whatever went wrong could have been done differently so that it would have gone right. So that's the level of the gardening of the past and the resolving of traumatic events and experiences. And evidently, it's better to do that before you go and do these projections into the future of decision taking. And that's, of course, why so many religion mystery schools advocate that people do meditations so that they actually can go into their alpha brainwave levels and resolve the traumatic charges of their memories, that they can go into the theta brainwave levels and heal the body and let go of traumatic experiences stored within them, coming from them or for them from their ancestors. And that it's also advocated to go to the deepest level of delta meditation to realize that and how our body is part of the universe and all life forms. That actually everything is linked in love. So when people have done that, they have cleaned up all these memories which don't work, replaced them by memories which could work. And so when you can then have to take a decision, you can look into your memory of what you think you know and then go into a dream state, daydream state, and think, find out what you know in your whole life, how could have been gone differently, what would be a nice optimal otherwise possible solution. You work with the level of ideas and ideals, and after doing that you come out with the result conclusions of what would work and what would not work. So you scrape all of the plans that you had which will not be beneficial for you or for others. Then you go to the deeper level, and the ones that you work with, you can test, put on the test bench then at that deeper level of, okay, what does your body know about survival on Earth in the way humans have been living in different circumstances and how to make do or how to make shelter, how to make bridges or tunnels or find other solutions. What does your body have to offer? And then again, you can find that some of the options that you thought are not possible, that at the level of concepts, you need to deconceptualize those and look for other concepts which you can work with. And then out of that body ancestral memory, you will find possibilities which actually are beneficial to Earth and to humanity and to all life forms. And then after that, of course, it is the deepest level where you tune into what the DNA or the genetic memory can tell you. And that essentially then computes it for what you can do as human in humanity for all life forms and for all Earth, because at that moment you become their ambassador. And with what you create, you will know what will be beneficial to all of those life forms and how they can support and work with each other in symbiosis. So that brings me to the end of this exploration, in which I essentially try to describe how I now understand that within us, we have actually a memory of billions of years, but it is stored in different levels. So yes, we do have the memory in our brain, which the neurologists and the psychologists, psychiatrists talk about. But that is no more than, say, the floppy disk of what we have experienced in the past. And actually, it is not stored in us in the past, but it is stored in us in the present. So in when we access the past in our memory, we are not accessing the past, but we are mainly accessing a photograph or a hologram image of something that happened in the past, which is still stored within us, as stories, stored within us, and which, when we access it, seems to play out in that time when it was recorded. But it is not that time that we then experience, but it's a record of the time that we then experience. But it does mean that within us we have all those kind of memories which we can access, which we can learn from, and as I mentioned before, which is really worthwhile to, in meditation and other exercises, de-traumatize, resolve, heal, so that all of these memories are freely available and none of them are stuck, and thereby avoid that those stuck memories actually become strange attractors and start to determine or cripple your life. And that's also why it's so important to realize that it is possible to access those memories, and that it is thereby also possible to discharge or decharge those memories, so that they become simply information by which you can never better navigate in the choices that you make in the life around you. So then when you have done that from the memories that you have and that you have freed up, and the memories that you've healed, the memories that you have made accessible, and then you know what for you would be a good thing to do. But that doesn't mean that it would work well for others. So you need to step beyond the selfish perspective and go into the perspective of you being the representative of humanity. And that is where you then need to go to the deeper level, which is not stored in the brain, but stored in the organs. And at that organ level, find out what happened in your body throughout your life at all levels, not just the memories that you remember, but also the memories that your body remembers. They're not stored as cognitive experiences, but they're stored as body experiences. And then suddenly you get a different and deeper layer of understanding, which connects to the healing of the body, to discharge the traumatic body memories, to restore the body integrity by reconnecting the body to the environment in a more open and more general way, and out of that to know how your actions fit into the environment. So it's no longer your personal experience, but it's now an experience in an environment, and the knowledge of which environment is best for what you try to do. Then you actually need to go deeper, because it's not just you being the ambassador for humanity and knowing how you can help your environment as well, but that as a species we have a memory of survival on Earth in all these different varieties and all these different people who came before you with all their stories and solutions, which are then stored in your cell memories, which you inherited from your ancestors, which they inherited from their ancestors, and so on. So that's where you can then, in your exploration of the decision you take, go to the deeper level of where have they been, what might they have experienced, what solutions do they have, what problems do they have, which others have solutions to overcome those problems, and how you then can connect that what you seek to do so that it actually fits not any environment, but every environment that you can imagine. And once you've done that, you can go to that deeper level of the DNA memories and trace that back to all life forms. So through the food chain, we interchange DNA with all life forms as well. So that at that level, you know how what you seek to do would fit in for any type of life form, and how that would play out for life on Earth in general. So essentially it means that when you take a decision, you think about it, and then you meditate on it, and then you deep trance meditate on it, and you deep trance meditate on it, and out of that you will have a much better understanding of how to connect to your body, how it connects to all of us, how to connect to all life forms. And that automatically what you do is beneficial for humanity, for all life forms, and for Earth. And that having 5 billion years of memory is really helpful to become a steward on Earth, to be able to plant paradise, so to say.